Morning, everyone. We do not have a quorum, but this is an informational hearing, so we're going to go ahead and get started. Representative Johnson, you're off the hook today. We don't have any minutes, so you were early, and I apologize that we don't have some work for you to do, but we'll save it for tomorrow.
Okay, I'll be ready.
And welcome to room five. This is kind of nice to be out of the dungeon and all the way up to the basement. So, I misspoke. Anyway, we're going to start out this morning with the Metropolitan Council. So if they want to come forward, then we'll get started with their presentation. And we will turn the show over to them. Welcome to committee. Chair Churimoff, nice to have you here with us early this morning. And go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and proceed with the presentation.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Aline Churimoff, and I'm the chair of the Metropolitan Council.
Aline. Can we get that volume turned up a bit on the testifier's microphone so those of us that are have less than perfect hearing have a chance of hearing what she has to say?
Sure. Is that better? Can you hear me now?
A little more, I think.
More?
When it starts squealing, then we know it's loud enough. Thank you.
Great. Okay, good. Well, I appreciate the opportunity to be with you here this morning to talk about an exciting topic of rapid bus in the metro. Just to get us started, I wanted to ground us in the governor's bonding proposal, which is really for $50 million of state funds requested to implement capital projects along our regional express bus and busway corridors. As you can see, what we would be requesting is really to try to continue the work of design, environmental planning, and actual construction of some of these key corridors in our region. When you think about what we're trying to do in terms of building out our overall transit system, really one of the key goals is obviously enhancing mobility. It's also a key component of it is our ability to provide access to jobs and get folks where they need to go. And so we in 2011, 2012 did a study of some of our highest frequency bus routes in the metro and found that there were roughly 11 corridors that we could potentially provide improved service on. If you look by themselves, these rapid bus lines that we're looking at, these potential 11 corridors over the entire metro, serve nearly 500,000 jobs, or one out of three jobs in the region. These corridors already carry about 80,000 rides each day, or nearly 30% of the system. And with these rapid bus improvements, by 2030, these corridors could carry up to 150,000 riders a day. When we're looking at kind of the build-out of the entire system of these 11 additional rapid bus routes, as well as the build-out of our light rail transit system, we would be able to serve nearly half of the region's jobs and connect them with frequent, reliable all-day transit. So when you look at our bus service right now and you look at kind of what the challenges are for our regular route riders, this, I think, pie chart is really, really quite stunning when you can see 23% of the time you're stuck at a red light if you're riding a regular route bus, and 32% of the time you spent boarding, and that's time for people to kind of come in the front door, shuffle and look for change, and then pay. And so there's a queue, right, for folks to get on the bus. But there's also kind of limited infrastructure in these corridors that really, I think, when you think about the amount of frequency and service that we provide in these corridors for the total number of people, the infrastructure really doesn't match the level of service. So, for example, some of these corridors carry 40% of the people using the roadway, but represent only 3% of the vehicles. And so what these investments really try to do is to try to match that service, match the infrastructure with the type of service that we're actually providing. So finding space, though, as you all know, in a built environment is really challenging. And you can see in this picture, this is the intersection at University and Snelling. The left-hand side was before the implementation of Snelling Avenue A-Line BRT, and then the photo is actually after, which I believe we ended up moving the bus stop south of the intersection to try to find additional space for that footprint of an enhanced station, but also to be able to provide a better service overall. So we have some kind of space challenges right now. I want to be able to show a visual, we wanted to be able to show a visual image and kind of a compelling image of what rapid bus transit could look like. So I'd like to just pause for a second and show this quick video.
For a really long time, Metro Transit's system has been really focused around the bus, and that's still what carries the majority of our customers, and those will continue to make those local stops every block, getting people access where they need it. So we're really focused now on looking at some of those routes and the ones where it makes a lot of sense to make our busiest bus routes the ones that we invest in to make them faster and more comfortable for our users. Starting in 2004, we branched out into light rail. In 2009, we added commuter rail. And now we're adding bus rapid transit to the mix as well. So with bus rapid transit, everything that we do with the ride is focused on making it faster and more comfortable for our riders. So first, we start by putting stations about every half mile instead of every block so that people are getting to their most used destinations, but the bus moves a lot faster over the course of its trip.
It's very simple and very, I think, efficient. For me personally, it gets me where I need to be.
We also add off-board fare payment to the mix. So much like on light rail, people pay their fares before they get on the bus, which means that when the bus pulls up, the doors open and people are able to get on through any door. At the stations, because there are fewer of them, we're really able to invest in making that a better place to catch the bus. So we add shelters with heat and light, security features, and real-time information that tells people when the bus is going to be there next.
The bus drivers work with you as well, so that's the bus they remodel too. If you have any questions, just ask the bus driver.
With transit signal priority, buses can communicate with lights to get more green time going through the corridor. Buses make fewer stops for a faster trip.
Right now I'm going to go on the A line and go to the midline. Alright, and it's quicker. Alright. And sometimes I use the 54 to go straight to the St. Paul Hotel level.
So these planned BRT corridors are really focused in a lot of the places where growth is targeted to happen in the region. By 2040, we expect another 700,000 people to be added to the region, and many of them will be along these core corridors. By making transit service a better option, we're giving people choices so that they're not always dependent on a car to get around. We know that by making this investment in the routes that are most used and making transit a really dignified way to get around, we can attract more people to using transit and ultimately lead to a stronger region.
Great. So as the video kind of laid out there, one of the benefits of creating bus rapid transit is that we have a kind of off-board payment system. I'll wait for just 1 second. No, you're fine. Well, actually, I can keep going because you have it in front of you. So we have the opportunity to do off-board fare payment, and that's, we have an app now. You can pay by credit, transit pass, to pay off-board, which really, if you look at the next slide, really makes boarding a lot faster. So if you look at our traditional bus, like I said earlier, you kind of get on in the front, pay, and then you can get off at either the front door or the back door. But this, with our BRT system, you can kind of get on or off at any door. So it really makes the amount of time that you're spent waiting to board or folks are waiting to get on obviously a lot faster. The other thing that helps to speed the trip along the corridor is transit signal priority, and that really goes back to that pie chart that you saw earlier. The amount of time that we spend at a red light, for example, is reduced because the ABRT system has transit signal priority. The other thing that I think is another amenity in terms of the service overall is that if you think about our light rail transit stations, they often have a pretty big footprint. Obviously, they need to have longer platforms to accommodate the trains for people to get on board and off board all along the platform. But these are, our stations for ABRT are much more kind of in the neighborhood scale. But they have a lot of amenities like real-time information, ticket vending machines, additional or enhanced security features with enhanced lighting, security cameras, emergency phones, heated shelters, enhanced maintenance, and then that you have that kind of clear boarding zone that you can see in the picture in front of you that it just has a slightly different look. To give you a real tangible example of arterial BRT in practice, we have the A line that runs from the Rosedale Mall down Snelling Avenue over the Ford Parkway into Minneapolis, connecting with the 46th Street Station. And it also connects actually with the Green Line at Snelling and University, which was one of the pictures that I showed earlier. This line opened in 2016 and was about $27 million in overall project cost, and largely replacing the local bus that was on that already provided service in that corridor. So from an operating cost perspective, we were able to kind of harvest the operating cost of the regular route bus. And then with the expansion of this additional service, we're looking at a roughly $2 million increase in overall annual service costs for the corridor. But I think if you look at the success of the system since implementation, we've seen a 32% increase in ridership on that corridor, which really shows, I think, or demonstrates the success of the line for a relatively modest investment. One of the interesting things about when you kind of dig into the ridership numbers along the corridor from April 2016 to 2017 is, you know, you might expect that we would see a fairly large increase in rides on the average weekday, but we actually saw a really big increase on the weekends. And that's those are folks who are not necessarily using ABRT just for commuting, but also for potentially for leisure. We had the A-line hit its 2030 ridership forecast during the state fair with 9,000 daily passengers. This is something that's been very successful overall. In addition to the high ridership numbers and the increased use of the corridor overall, we have seen a 94% the corridor has received or actually achieved 94% on-time performance, which is above the local service, which is about roughly about 80%. So that's an increase of on-time performance. We also set a goal of a 25% faster service, so kind of end-to-end. If you were riding the system, folks would experience a 25% faster ride, and we were able to achieve that as well. So you can really see that there's an we're getting very good feedback as well from customers that they really like the service. It's faster, it's more reliable. You know that the bus is going to come every 10 minutes, so you don't have to spend a lot of time trying to figure out when's my next bus coming. And one of the features that I didn't mention when we were looking at the station amenity is that there's a red T in the middle, and it kind of lights up when the bus is coming. So there's also like a visual cue, in addition to being able to see the screen and the actual number of how many minutes away the bus is. There's also kind of a visual element that I was showing my kids the other day. They really enjoyed that. We have seen not only from our riders but also from around the region broad support for these rapid bus improvements. And I think that the A-line has really been able to provide a strong, tangible example of the benefits that rapid bus can confer. And so this is just an example of the folks that have already come out and said that they support additional investment in rapid bus. We are also working on now construction of the C line, which is another rapid bus corridor that's about 8.5 miles running from downtown Minneapolis, west on Olson Memorial, north on Penn Avenue to Brooklyn Center Transit, Transit Center. This project is about $37 million, and we were actually able to leverage a significant amount of federal grants to get this project done. We don't expect to see that for our future projects, but we were able to kind of take advantage of some federal grants available to cover about 80% of the project cost. One of the exciting things about this corridor as well is that we've also received a federal grant for battery electric buses. And so we have 8 battery electric buses that will be manufactured right here in Minnesota, just up the road in St. Cloud, along with 6 clean diesel buses that will burn 20% biodiesel, will burn a 20% biodiesel blend in the summer months. So that's another exciting element of the C line. That's under construction, will be open next year. The next corridor that we are currently planning and what our bonding proposal would help to fund is the D line, which would largely replace the Route 5 corridor, which runs from Brooklyn Center through Minneapolis, down Richfield, and into the Mall of America. This is our highest ridership route in the system. We currently have about 15,000 weekly rides, and it's really an opportunity for significant enhancements on this corridor. If you can see the statistic up there, it takes about 70 to 100 minutes right now to ride end-to-end on this route. So the D-Line rapid bus proposal would be, again, about 18.2 miles, looking at trying to make the service every 10 minutes and 20 to 25% faster than the current Route 5 service. For about a $75 million investment, we're looking at 2030 ridership projections of 23,500 rides a day. So relatively modest investment for a significant increase in rides overall. And just in terms of the additional cost for operations, that would be roughly $4 million in addition to the current regular route bus service. So we would, again, like we did on the Snelling Avenue line, kind of pull some of the operational costs that we use for the regular route bus and put those into this new enhanced service. Once we finish construction and actually getting the funding in place for that D line, we've also looked at other lines in our corridor, with the next one that we have contemplated would be the B line, and that is our second highest ridership route in the system, and that would give us an opportunity to kind of connect that Lake and Marshall area. We have other lines across the system that we're looking at improvements for, if there are opportunities to advance federal dollars or if there's kind of readiness components that coincide with the construction of any one of these bus lines, we would have the opportunity to kind of look at how we prioritize and allocate those. In our proposal for $50 million in bonding, we are also looking at opportunities for express bus improvements along other guideways, for example, the Orange Line corridor, Park and Ride potentially, or the Gold Line, Woodbury Park and Ride. And so what we would do with this money is really kind of look at the projects that are ready, the projects that would have a significant return on investment, and at the ability to provide enhanced bus service for our riders. I think just to close, I would say that when we're looking at trying to enhance mobility, again, across the region, we're looking at building not only enhancing our regular route bus service, but enhancing opportunities for rapid bus as well as just kind of the entire system overall with light rail and the capital development of these major transitways. So with that, Mr. Chair and members, I'd be happy to stand for questions. I also have and should have introduced earlier Mr. Charles Carlson, who's the Senior Manager of Bus Rapid Transit at Metro Transit. So thank you.
Thank you. Before we go further, I'm going to officially call the meeting to order now that we have a quorum. So I'm going to call to order the meeting of the House Transportation Finance Committee for Wednesday, April 5th. We are officially in order, and then we have questions. We'll start with Representative Rundick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Chermoff. This is really exciting. The question I have, though, is the whole issue of economic development. We've, you know, been hearing for years that in order to assure that you're going to have economic development along routes, that we have to have light rail, we have to have something fixed in the ground. How does this compare in terms of just the economic development opportunities?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Rumbach. I think that there are opportunities for some economic development along the corridors. I think in terms of tracking, I'm not sure that we have really tracked the numbers in the same way, but I do have some anecdotes in terms of what's happened on Snelling Avenue and folks saying that they really do like the A-line. I think being able to see the tangible benefits of something like bus rapid transit now demonstrated so clearly in the A-line, I think the compelling case for additional development potentially along those corridors could also help to drive that argument for development along bus rapid transit corridors.
All right.
Follow-up, Representative Rumbach.
So the $50 million, is it specifically then covering just expansion of D and E, or will it also be the possible B line and E line? I mean, how far does the money go?
So we
Sorry,
Mr. Chair and Representative Rundbeck. We would look to advance the remainder of what's the money that we need to advance the D line, and then look at opportunities for additional planning on other corridors as well as any kind of advanced design along those.
Well, and Mr. Chair,
Representative Rundbeck.
Will the legislature have a chance to see, you know, exactly that fiscal plan, where the money is going, what the anticipated cost, you know, for each corridor will be?
Chair Chermoff.
Mr. Chair and Representative Rumbeck, we could provide that to the legislature. We, this proposal, actually, if we kind of step back and look at the 11 proposed corridors, we're looking at roughly a $400 to $500 million network overall, and that would just kind of be in that arterial BRT system.
Representative Hausman has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What happened to Rushline, Red Rock, and Riverview, which are the three East Metro, increasingly transit-dependent people there, as Representative Hornstein discovered, you can't get there from here. I mean, there are massive areas that just simply don't have aren't part of the system now, and the more the system grows, the more isolated those areas become. So I would be interested in Rushline, Red Rock, and Riverview.
Chair Chermoff.
Madam, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hausman. so we actually do depict the Riverview and the rush lines on this map just to show that those are projects that we know that are in development and are looking to either select their locally preferred alternative or kind of moving through the development development phases. I think we had looked at those as some of our six bigger capital transitway investments in our region. Especially Riverview and Rush Lines, looking at those as maybe potentially new starts or new starts projects, really, ultimately, when they're developed. So they're in a slightly different category, I would say, from what we're thinking of these arterial bus improvements. Those are larger. We know that they'll require big federal environmental reviews because we would be likely seeking federal assistance in, to develop those projects.
And a follow-up, Representative Hausman.
Yes, thank you. I think the frustration we have is we've been talking about those corridors for a long time, and it sounds as though when I hear your answer that these are just brand new ideas, there are new starts, and we've been talking about those corridors for just a very long time, and it means, for example, that St. Paul doesn't have a connection to the airport.
Chair Chermoff.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hausman, I call them new starts because that's the name of the federal program. I didn't mean to imply that they were new projects. It's just called the New Starts program at the FTA. Those projects are actually really, I think, moving along in their local planning in terms of selecting an alignment and really trying to move through the early stages of project development before they enter into the, what we call the FTA queue for review and approvals. So those are I would say in the works. We had originally planned, if you kind of look through the history of planning arterial BRT, the first line was that we developed was the A line on Snelling Avenue. There was previously a plan to connect bus rapid transit from St. Paul to the airport, but the local units of government kind of came back and gave us feedback that they wanted to make sure that that corridor had the opportunity for additional investments in transit like either light rail or streetcar, and I think at this point they're contemplating streetcar in that corridor.
And, Mr. Chair, just a comment about this. What I understand is that our economic competitors across the Midwest who are moving more rapidly than we are have discovered that in some cases you do better if you don't depend on the federal money, that if you do it locally, you do it faster and cheaper than going through that cumbersome federal process. And I don't know if there's any conversation about that in our area.
Chair
Chermoff. Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, yes, I think we have looked at those options. I think the challenge for us at Met Council and Met for Transit is just for revenues, the available revenue. I think we would be happy to advance projects more rapidly. I think part of the challenge is just knowing you have a reliable funding source that's kind of dedicated for long-term investments like these that we know we need to make and to support the economic vitality of our region.
Representative Kosnick has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Chair Chermoff. Thank you for being here. Kind of an exciting project that we're discussing. And, you know, to me, they kind of look and seem a little bit like these arterial lines, kind of like express line. I'm not sure exactly how you classify the differences, but do you know what the operating subsidies are on these proposed 11 corridors that you have before us?
Chair Chermoff.
Hang on just 1 second. I do have that number. Oh, here it is. So, Mr. Chair and Representative Kosnick, I have the operating subsidy for the A line. I don't have it for the future lines because we don't yet know exactly. But the A line has about a $3.15 subsidy per passenger on weekdays, so that's about a 25% fare recovery. If you compare that to bus overall in 2017, that regular route buses is about 21% fare box recovery, or $4.23. So it's the fare box recovery is higher. The subsidy is lower on these on the A line.
Representative Costa.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know what that translates into. I suppose you back out the math on the ridership that you just mentioned earlier, but on an annual basis, and who's covering that operating subsidy then? Is it just the Met Council or Metro Transit? Or is it is there a local share participating in that?
Chair Chermoff.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kosnick, that comes out of the overall operating cost of the system.
Representative Kosnick, a final question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And then, so how does that operating subsidy, how does that compare with express lines, which are very similar, that do in fact have a local share participation? And I think, you know, for the region that we're planning this out, that, you know, I think we might want to look at having it be similar.
Chair Chermoff.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kosnick, are you referring to the Orange Line in terms of the express? I'm sorry, just to clarify your question.
Representative Kosnick.
Mr. Chair, I am very fond of the Orange Line, but I'm talking about any express lines that we would have in the future for the system, but I just think the subsidies, why are they not funded similarly?
Chair Chermoff.
Mr. Chair, I might phone a friend here with Mr. Carlson to help me with the express bus.
Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your answer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Charles Carlson, Senior Manager for Bus Rapid Transit Projects. The express bus lines are also funded similarly from the regular operating budget of the Met Council, which is the combination of fare revenue, motor vehicle sales tax, and general fund appropriations. In the case of some of our transitway lines, we will have agreement by local sponsors that really led a lot of the early planning of these lines, and then have a share in the operations as well, both for light rail and for BRT.
Thank you. I will have to move on. Mm-hmm. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of things. First of all, on this question of subsidy, I believe that the opt-out project that's in the omnibus bill had something like an $18 per passenger subsidy, maybe even north of 20. So if you want to start to, you know, make comparisons and ask all these projects to have similar subsidies, I think we would do a lot better with a project like this and our local bus system and the Orange Line compared to some of those others. Just an observation. And I wanted to let the committee know that in May I'll be celebrating just 2 years of being carefree and car free, and the A-Line has been a part of my transit experience, and I can attest personally to all of the things that the chair has said. You know, it is a great ride. It is on time. It is reliable. It is comfortable. It is fast, and I'm really excited about the map and your plans for the future. And, Mr. Chair and members, I had a chance to tour the part of the corridor a couple weeks ago for the D line, and very impressed with that route as well and your other plans. In the course of that tour, I learned that, you know, you had mentioned the 23,000 daily riders and that the total cost is $75 million. And so clearly a portion of that will come from bonding. But if you could just lay out very specifically the other pots of money and how much you're anticipating for that D-Line project, then my guess is it would be similar for the others. I'm really interested in the multiple sources of money that you had outlined on that tour.
Chair Chermoff.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hornstein, I actually don't have those numbers in front of me. I'm going to ask Charles to respond to that. Thank
okay.
you.
Thank you, Mr. Carl. Chair. Representative Hornstein, we've identified roughly $40 million today that is primarily a mix of federal dollars and local match. Of those federal dollars, we've actually secured three competitive grants that have been awarded by the Transportation Advisory Board for a mix of expansion and modernization of this corridor. We received similar grants for the Sea Line project. In the case of the Sea Line, the limited amounts of those grants was able to cover the project cost. In the case of the D Line, because it's a larger corridor, we'll reach the capacity of those kinds of grants in this case. In addition to that, we'll also be using formula modernization dollars. So instead of buying regular buses for this line, we'd be using the funds that we'd be replacing buses with anyway to buy the larger BRT vehicles. So it's a use of modernization dollars in addition to expansion grants.
Representative Hornstein, a follow-up.
Thank you. And again, Mr. Carlson and Ms. Roth especially, I really appreciate your work on this. I wanted to thank you. But just a follow-up, what I'm really interested in is, so we have the $75 million cost. How much do you anticipate, for example, for the D-Line, I'm saying? And I don't know, is the D-Line before the C-Line, or are they kind of simultaneous? That's one question. But then the second question, I just want to dig in a little deeper on the cost and the pots of money you're looking at. So how much would be state bonding, for example? How much would be the federal New Starts program? How much would be, some kind of combination of local funds? Do you have those figures at all?
Mr. Carlson, I'm thinking that's a little more detail than we have time for this morning, so okay. If you could get that information to the committee and to Representative Hornstein.
I think it would be really helpful because, I'll say that I think that, it's no secret that there's differences of opinion among the parties about support for transit. And I'm hoping that arterial bus rapid transit in particular, is an area of consensus. It's something that we can all get together and support. To that extent, I think the more specific we could get in terms of the funding needs for these projects, I think the better it might be, the smoother sailing it could be, in terms of getting this done. So sure. I'm really, really hopeful that that this could be that one area of consensus that we're looking for in transit, and it may lead to others. But this is a good start that the council's had. I applaud you, and I think this is a very exciting prospect. But again, to the extent that we know where we fit in as the legislature in your vision for funding, it would be helpful, as specific as possible. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Bernardi has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple questions, and one I'm sad to report to this committee that another pedestrian has been killed on the corridor, which we brought up last week. This is now, last week MnDOT reported it was 8 in 18 months. We are now up to 9, so I'm very sorry to report that a 51-year-old was killed in a crash. A pedestrian was killed last night.
Where was it? Where did this happen?
At 85th and University Avenue.
Thank you.
And the reason I bring this up is this is in this corridor that I didn't know about last week, but we brought up the need for a study along 53rd Avenue all the way up University to just south of Highway 10, and it's around 85th Avenue, a little bit north of that. And part of this is a transit oriented development, as well as heavily used in transit. And I just wanted to make sure and ask, what are your safety plans in having transit corridors and enhancing transit corridors in areas that were moving cars very fast? I had to intervene about 3 years ago or so. I don't know the exact time frame when MnDOT upped the speed limit by 5 miles an hour in this area to 55. Area just south of where this person was killed, and without even consulting the city. So there's really important that there's collaboration between departments on the use of a highway, the speeds, the safety of all users, especially where transit is. And I wanted to know, what is the plan for these all your corridors, but especially the BRT corridors?
Chair Chermo.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think I can give you an example of what we did, for example, on the Snelling Avenue, the A-Line BRT, which is a trunk highway. We really coordinated closely with MnDOT to try to not only make the enhancements that we needed for the bus improvements, but also just for the roadway overall. I think you know that you would know that there's portions of that Snelling Avenue that were redone at the same time that we were working on the A line. I would say also, for example, on the C line that is under construction right now, we worked really closely with Hennepin County, which is the owner of the main roadway for Penn Avenue, which the C line runs up for a large portion of the alignment, and worked really closely with their community developers to try to enhance also that roadway, enhance the design elements and the safety, making it safer for pedestrians.
Okay, so, Mr. Chair, I just really want to encourage that to be a top priority, is safety for all users on a roadway, especially when there's transit is being used in that corridor, and that we're just not prioritizing moving cars fast, but it's creating an environment where everyone can be safe no matter what mode of transportation they use on that corridor.
Representative Varick has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'd like to start by recognizing Representative Hornstein's comments about, I believe, bus rapid transit is something that both parties can get behind. I prefer this far more to the rail systems because of the flexibility and that. One of the concerns that I'm was just wondering about seeing the prepay option, like with the light rail. Is there any means that you have, do you do random checks to see that people have paid, or is it basically just up to the rider?
Chair Chermoff.
Mr. Chair and Representative Berwick, yes, we do. Metro Transit does conduct fare checks on the A-line as well as our LRT system. So we do the kind of regular checking. I could give you an example. On the A-line, we had a statistic of about 8,000 fares inspected in March of this year.
A follow-up, Representative Berwick.
And then on a different line, I just want clarification on a statement you made on the line along Snelling, that you hit your 2030 projections during the state fair, but was that only during the state fair? I mean, your daily ridership has not come to those numbers at this point, correct?
Chair Chermo.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berwick, we are on track to meet the 2030 numbers, but you're correct. We hit that 2030 number during the state fair.
Okay. Thank you. I've just got a couple quick questions, and then we'll wrap up. One, what about mobility on these lines as far as access for those disabled patrons?
Mr. Chair, it's fully accessible. Our buses, I think they either the station platform is higher so that it's easy to kind of roll on and off. I think all of our buses now can be low floor to allow accessibility for enhanced accessibility for everyone.
And a follow-up to that, do you expect that to have any impact on Metro Mobility numbers or usage in any way?
Mr. Chair, we do hope that as we enhance the transit system and there's more reliability in it overall as well as accessibility overall, that obviously our first choice would be for folks to take transit because it's cheaper overall in terms of subsidy versus Metro Mobility. And as we enhance the transit system, we're hoping that more folks can just take transit instead of needing a Metro Mobility ride. And so that's certainly a hope of ours.
And do you have any way of tracking that?
Do we track that? Mr. Chair, I'm not sure. I might have to get back to you on that one.
Thank you. And one final question. I read about the impact of Uber and Lyft and other rideshare services that people are tending to utilize those. Are those having an impact on the usage of the Metro Transit system?
Mr. Chair, I would say that's actually one of the reasons why I would say that the A-line ridership in the A-line ridership increase in the corridor is actually really an interesting story, because that corridor itself had a 33% increase in ridership, whereas bus rides overall declined last year. At the same time, we saw record ridership on our LRT lines and our commuter rail lines. So we're seeing a little bit of a mix in terms of where folks are going. We have higher ridership on our LRT lines, higher ridership on the A line, and then lower ridership on just the regular route buses.
Thank you. Well, thank you for being with us today. Any final remarks before we wrap up?
No, Mr. Chair and members, I'd just like to say thank you so much for the opportunity to talk about this exciting opportunity to invest in regional mobility. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both for being with us today. Now we're going to move on to the next topic of best value contracts. Representative Nash. We do not have the Representative Nash bill in our possession, but Representative Nash does have a DE that I believe he's going to address.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members. This bill is designed to have a conversation around a repeatable, definable, fair set of metrics that go into contracting. And I go back to my time when I was a mayor, and I know many of you served in city government or local government, and one of the hallmarks that I enjoyed in portraying to the constituents that I had was that anytime we decided to spend money, we could point to the reasons that we chose to do so. That we could say, here is the list, and sometimes I actually would hold up a list of things that went into making our decision. I can't always say that that's the case for projects that are being done currently. And the stakeholders that you'll hear today will share some details about why it's important for us to really step in and hopefully eventually move this to where it can become a reality. And I think that all of us, when we look to our own constituents who will ask us questions about a highway or a project that was built, how did you arrive, or how did we arrive at those decisions? So in the interest of getting the message out, I have testifiers that are here. Mr. Chair, if you would indulge us.
Thank you. We'll go ahead and testify. I don't know who you want first. Welcome to committee. Please identify yourself for the record. Go ahead with your testimony.
Yes, good morning, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Tim Warkey. I'm the CEO of the Associated General Contractors of Minnesota. We're a statewide construction trade association representing both vertical builders and highway builders. And I'm going to try to be as brief as I can today and want to point out that my remarks today are focused on the highway section, obviously, in front of you. But let me just clarify for a minute for in front of Representative Nash's comments. Best value is what's called an alternate procurement, something that was passed, I believe, by the legislature in 2006. And it provides kind of a unique differentiation between the lowest responsible bidder, where price is the biggest or is the sole determinant. But best value utilizes a combination of price and then other factors that you are scored on that are deemed to bring value to the owner. And then a scoring criterion and a formulaic application is applied in order to determine which contractor has brought the best value for the owner. So let me start for a minute by telling you about why our association is involved and has been involved in all of the alternate procurements that this body has considered going back 20-plus years. We have led the development and supported passage of the following alternate procurement laws and proposals. In 2001, the state law designed build for highways. In 2005, a procurement alternatives for construction manager at risk and job order contracting. In 2013, the passage of construction manager general contractor. And then again, this year you recall that we put forward the option or opportunity for public-private partnerships or P3. So we have been a leader in trying to propose a progressive approach to contracting that brings value and fairness to all uses of public taxpayer dollars. Some factors that we consistently press for in each of those models: transparency, number one, fairness to all of the proposers, that, as Representative Nash mentioned, that there is a base level of consistency amongst the criterion because there are multiple public owners across the state, and that objective and measurable criterion be utilized to the greatest extent practicable. And I'd just like to say that we pride ourselves in the relationships that we've maintained with the public ownership bodies, everybody from MnDOT to the Department of Admin to Hennepin County to the University of Minnesota and other public bodies, about how these models can be applied and how they can best be utilized. Let me turn to best value, which I mentioned was passed in 2006. We believe that the best value law stands as really an outlier that lacks the benefit of thoughtful deliberation and broad vetting from stakeholders when it was enacted in 2006. The best value law, in our opinion, is ill-defined and contains few express restrictions on its use or application. The open-endedness and unrestricted authority was cited by AGC during the law's development in 2006. At the time, assurances were made that best practices would be formulated and training for public owners in how to use, and maybe more importantly, how not to use best value would be provided once the law was enacted. We believe that those commitments were largely ignored. We believe that taxpayer dollars should be prudently invested and that policymakers and the public should be able to easily discern how much they are paying for deliverables in each procurement. Because best value tends to roll together all of the activities that define value to the owner, it is often difficult to break out each component and determine how much it costs and the return on investment, which is one measure of value. Contractors' overall price is inclusive of each of these activities or deliverables and may or may not include a specific cost allocation for those deliverables. Today we're seeing best value utilized by all levels of government in creative and, we believe, unintended ways. The flexibility is made possible because most procurement models by nature have a level of best value calculus that's inherent in their structure. For example, the state's design-build law for highways is design-build best value. It has a value determinant in it. Where express statutory procurement authority is not available to a public owner, we have seen instances where the owner chooses to use whatever procurement model they deem appropriate for the project or the project circumstance, and then labeling it a best value procurement. Additionally, with the myriad numbers of public owners letting public contracts under best value authority, there are countless differing criterion to which contractors must be responsive. Because of the lack of defined and consistent statutory criteria to measure best value, we believe there's an exposure and open-ended opportunity for public owners to potentially manipulate the criteria on a project-by-project basis to meet predetermined results and/or conclusions. Let me illustrate that point with an example. In my own home community, which is a southern suburb community, there was a best value procurement a few years back that had criterion applied to it that the contractor must have, within the previous 2 years, had completed a project within the city or within a contiguous city to the owner's satisfaction. There are two concerns with that. Number one, owner satisfaction is a subjective determination. But number two, it's a way to keep a contractor out of that city by saying if you had not performed a project within that city or within its contiguous borders with other cities that you could not bid on the project or you would be scored less than your competitors. The lack of consistency across public bidding authorities that use best value creates an unlevel and often cumbersome bidding and proposing atmosphere for contractors. Contractors regularly work for multiple owners across the state, responding to proposal opportunities that use and apply best value determining criteria in differing ways is expensive for contractors and arguably may not be in the best interest of the taxpayer. We believe the legislation that we have brought forward today with Representative Nash's concurrence provides a reasonable accommodation for some of the concerns that I've outlined, while still preserving the opportunity to bring innovation and measurable value to public owners and taxpayers. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Werke. We have another testifier. Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Abby Bryduck. I'm the Government Affairs Director at the Associated General Contractors. Thank you for the time this morning to talk about this contracting method, and thank you for your attention to take sort of a deep dive into procurement concepts here. But there are two points that we want to make about best value and the way it has been used. One is about objectivity, which Mr. Werke referenced, and the other is about how we might effectively use diversity and inclusion measurements in a best value procurement. One of the documents that you have is the I-35W Lake Street Pilot Project bid. This is the more recent project that's been done using best value, and this is distinctive because it's the first project that we've seen best value used on a low bid project, whereas typically best value is used on more complex projects where you want to, where it might be a design build and you want to leverage collaboration and innovation of that partnership. And so you want something a little bit more than just the lowest price. You want a good team. You're willing to pay a little more for that. This project is not considered one of those special projects, but it is low bid. But the best value concept was applied on top of that. So, if you go through some of these scoring criteria, so you get your lowest price, the price is one item, and then you get these other items that the contractors have to respond to, and they're given a score, which is combined in an overall evaluation. But you'll see risk understanding and mitigation approach, diversity and inclusion, small business contracting. And the approaches for those items request a narrative description of maybe a contractor's understanding of a concept or of their approach to how to accomplish those goals. And while we don't have an issue necessarily with the content of these items and the goal and the things they are trying to achieve, we feel that these narrative descriptions are very open to various interpretations and hard to point back to and say this is a measurable item that you're going to bring to the job. And so you also might see under the small business inclusion portion specifically, there is a request to discuss matchmaking events, advertising opportunities, conducting market research. I mean, these are all various activities that may or may not have to do specifically with construction, and not that they're not valuable and wouldn't be helpful in these goals, but is this the proper way to do it, and is this the proper way to award a contract based on these promises or speculations of future activities? We have concerns with that. I also want to mention that to the end of these workforce inclusion goals is that on these projects, MnDOT already has a workforce and inclusion goal that must be met or must be shown to have done enough activity to try to get there, a good faith effort, they call it. And before they embark on the project, they've got to put in place an affirmative action plan, which has to be approved. So we feel that adding this in a best value document is duplicative and also, you know, may not promise the best results. In response to this particular procurement, you have a spreadsheet which, for the diversity and inclusion portion, this was what the winning bid came out as their plan for diversity and inclusion. And there are a lot of valuable activities on this sheet. I think we would say, however, that we don't know that there aren't necessarily performance metrics applied to these. We don't know if these activities will actually produce the requested results. Holding quarterly career fair events, attending job fairs, mock interviews, graduations, coaching sessions. We also don't know how much these activities cost to the contractor and ultimately to the taxpayers. So these items are sort of lumped in. There's a line item in a bid document that says this is how much this is going to cost us. It just has to be considered into the bid. So the other thing I just wanted to point out was, as far as an approach that we feel would be appropriate for diversity and inclusion specifically is, another document you have is the Hennepin County Best Value Procurement Scoring Criteria. And you'll see that they list, they go through their formula to show how they get to the points to award a bid. Exactly half of it is based on cost. And then you'll see the non-cost factors, which are company experience, key personnel experience, risk plan, delivery and risk. These are items that are specific to project delivery that we think are relevant in a bid document. But their approach to subcontractor participation, SBE, small business, which also would include disadvantaged businesses, is they require the contractor to actually list the small and disadvantaged businesses that they will use on the project. So this is a direct, objective, and measurable way to say that you're prioritizing inclusion and that we will score you on this. And if you have more inclusion, we may, your price may not matter as much. This is something that we value and that we would pay more for. So, but this is, when we talk about objective and measurable, this is the kind of objective and measurable approach that we think is more appropriate. And as far as workforce, this has been under discussion in many forums. That current workforce makeup is really a reflection of the current market conditions and should be approached with sort of a macro concept where we're working big picture. How do we increase workforce diversity? Not necessarily on a project-by-project initiative. And really, an individual contractor cannot change that for that specific project. A lot of times we have longer projects like the 35W Lake Street. It's a four-year project. That doesn't mean that the same workers are going to be on the job the whole time. Different stages of construction come and go. So you might work on this project for 4 months, and then the company might send you up to Hinckley to do something else. So there really isn't an opportunity necessarily to guide this workforce through a project because they're very they can be very transient. So we do think that item should be addressed in a different way. And then finally, MnDOT does have a best value procurement model or manual, which is one of the documents you also have. They have a checklist for implementing best value procurement, where it specifically mentions, will there be measurable benefits and value added through best value? And so, you know, we think they have this manual right. The guidelines here are right. But as we go along, as Mr. Werke suggested, we're starting to see more creative uses of the method. And we'd like to sort of preserve the sanctity of this method while using more appropriate methods to achieve different types of goals on construction projects. And so, finally, you know, our bill in reality just adds two words to the best value statute for highway projects, which is that criteria be objective and measurable. And in keeping with MnDOT's philosophy throughout the best value procurement manual, we think that this should be an agreeable concept. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I don't see any member questions at the moment. Representative Nash, is that all of your testifiers?
Mr. Chair, yes.
I believe we are going to hear from the department next. Is that correct? According to my agenda. Welcome to committee. Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Tom Raven. I'm the state construction engineer for MnDOT. I just have some brief comments for the committee today. Just to put to use our best value that this law addresses into context, the vast majority of our projects are done design, bid, build, low bid. We let approximately 200 to 250 projects a year. This legislation was passed in 2006, as Mr. Werke said. And I was involved in going to those hearings back in 2006, and there was a lot of frustration among the contracting community. I took note of that. At MnDOT, we want to make sure that we weren't abusing the authority to do that, so we've been very judicious about how we use that. As a matter of fact, we've only used it on one project in the last 10 years, and that was the 35W Lake Street. And that is a very unique project, very large project, a lot of impact to the traveling public, 100,000 cars a day out there. It's very important that we got a very good contracting team, which we did. We were very successful. We're fortunate in Minnesota to have very good contractors, and they are very progressive. and they recognize the benefit of alternative contracting and best value in our design build program. So this is a tool that we like to use in our design bid build program as well. Again, very judiciously using it where we need to use it. So this legislation does not affect our CMGC or design build, the two methods that Mr. Werke mentioned earlier. Unfortunately, with the language that they're proposing, objective and measurable, it really takes best value out of our toolbox for design bid build, because it's almost impossible to remove all the subjectivity from useful criteria that we want to use to make it more valuable to get a better contractor. Some of the other criteria that we've used that are very important to us are risk understanding and abatement. When we're going to hire a contractor for a $250 million project, we want to make sure they understand that project. They understand all the things that go along with it. And how they're going to manage that. Our projects are becoming so complex with environmental and different regulations that we really need contractors that are engaged. We don't want them just bidding the numbers off of our estimated quantities and not having any idea how they're going to manage it. So we want to, so to say, open up the hood and look at the engine a little bit. That's all we're asking to do. Some of the other criteria that we've used are key personnel. Key personnel are the people that are going to build the job. They're the ones who are going to manage the workforce out there. It's very important that we be able to evaluate the key personnel. And if you're talking about just objective and measurable, how do you do that? You've got to have 5 or 10 years experience. We want to be able to look at that experience to see what it is, to see it's applicable to the project that we're building. And if we can't do that, it really doesn't add much value. Also, one of the criteria on the 35W Lake Street was local impact. We happen to get the same team on this project that did the Crosstown Commons several years ago. And there's a lot of impact to that community, a lot of public relations, a lot of closures. And we really need a contracting team that recognizes that so that they can work with the community. We can look ahead, let them know what the impacts are going to be. There's noise, there's vibrations, all kinds of things that we want the contractors to anticipate. We also want them to look at the risk and understanding of the project. How are you going to mitigate that? When there's problems that come up, when there's things that aren't addressed in the plan, how are we going to work with the owner to make that happen, to make the changes in a timely manner so that we can stay on schedule with the project? The 35W Lake Street project is a 4-year project. It's a very tight timeline. So we really need to keep things on a fast pace. If we run into an issue with a contractor we can't resolve or can't look ahead, I mean, it's really going to be a major impact to the public. So those are the reasons that we want to use best value. Quality is another issue. How do you measure quality? That's a difficult thing for us to do in that industry. We can look at pavement quality, densities, things like that, but there's other intangible things that are really hard to measure. So it's very difficult to measure a lot of these things. So just to mention, I'm not going to go into the other criteria there. One other thing I want to mention, we're not against objective criteria. As a matter of fact, on 35W Lake Street, schedule was a criteria. And we actually had points for getting the project done in a number of days in advance of a certain date. So the earlier you got the project done, the more points you got. So we're not against objectionable. We just want the ability to have subjective because, quite frankly, if this bill were to pass, we could have an argument on every job. We would see a lot of bid protests for those that didn't get successful in getting the project. And probably 99% of the time when we use best value in any type of procurement, the low bidder is also the best value. So it's very rare that the best value part flips the bid. And then just one last comment. Best value is really growing in the country. And we've got some really progressive contractors here that have really embraced the best value and wanting to be really one with the owner. And construction manager, general contractor has been very successful for that. We're going to be coming back to the legislature hopefully in the next year or two and asking for authority to do that permanently. So we're hoping that, you know, the contracting community gets on board with us. I think some of them have really embraced it. So it's been a good program, and I think if this bill were to pass, we really would be going backwards. So with that, I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Raven. So we've heard about, you know, a number of different types of contracting that's available to the department. Can you give us a little more information about how you determine which type of contract you're going to issue, make available for which projects?
Sure, Mr. Chair. We go through a project delivery process early on, depending on the project. Some of it depends on, you know, what is the funding, when do we have to have the project designed. So a lot of times we get money late in our process. In order to deliver the projects, we need to accelerate. Sometimes we use design build to do that. Construction manager, general contractor, we've used that on several bridge projects. We're using that currently on the high bridge right now. We don't necessarily have all the expertise. We don't know how a contractor is going to construct a job, but by doing CMGC, where we bring the contractor on during the design phase of the project, we're able to collaborate with them in order to take advantage of their strengths to do the job. In the case of the high bridge, we were very concerned about how we would, I don't want to get too technical here, detension that bridge so that when we took the deck off, we wouldn't have problems. And we were able to do that in collaboration with a contractor, and it worked out well. It really takes all the risks out for the contractor, and risk for contractors is money. So we don't want contractors bidding risk in our project because it doesn't do anybody any good. So it depends on the complexity of the project.
And, Mr. Raven, do you feel that it's valuable to have all these different types of contracts in your toolbox? Do we need this wide variety of options, or is it just a little more confusing?
Mr. Chair, yes, we need them all. It's as things get more and more complex, as our personnel change, we want to have the right tool for the project, and CMGC and design build have been wonderful. We wouldn't have design build without AGC support, so we do have a good relationship with them. We want to maintain that, but we feel strongly that design bid build best value. And even though we've only used it once in 10 years, we feel that it is a strong component of our toolbox that we need to maintain.
And do you see the same variety of contracts in use in other states?
Mr. Chair, yes. I'm not sure how many states are using design bid build best value, but they are using CMGC and design build.
Very good. I have a member question from Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Riv, my question is, do any of these various types of contracts provide some advantage to smaller companies or newer companies?
Mr. Riv.
Chair, Mr. Representative, with the recent with CMGC, where we're able to bring the contractor on, what we do is we'll design that project in collaboration with the contractor, and then we'll work throughout the design process to come up with a price. So in actuality, you're negotiating that price, and we also have independent cost estimates. But I think it makes it easier for the contractors to incorporate disadvantaged business enterprises and small businesses, because often the criticism from contractors is the DBEs cost more than our normal contractors. Well, with CMGC, you're able to incorporate that cost into your proposal. And the owner knows it, and they don't have to guess, well, what is a reasonable bid? So, yeah, there are some advantages.
Follow-up, Representative.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And then my follow-up on that is, do any of these various types of contracts provide advantage to those contractors who are hiring minority workers at a larger percentage?
Mr. Raven.
Chair, Representative, as part of the money received from the federal government, Federal Highway Administration, Code of Federal Regulations, we're required to have a EEO DBE program. So one of the things that we wanted to do with the 35W Lake Street, the best value, by including that was by law, we can't give more points like Hennepin County does for the increased DB participation. Our attorneys say we can't do that. It gets into the quotas and things like that. But what we can do is we can ask them, what is your approach to increasing the EEO DB participation, hiring minorities on your projects? I think in the past, we haven't been real diligent about enforcing that. The contractors would submit their EEO plans in general, and that there really was no follow-up on it. Our civil rights office is doing a much better job following through with them. Now we have software the contractors have to submit electronic payroll, so we know minorities that are working on their staff. They're more aware of it, they're more cognizant of it, and they're doing a much better job. They're doing a great job, as a matter of fact. So there is a benefit to that.
Thank you, Mr. Raven. I believe Mr. Werke wants to make some final remarks, and then I've got to rewind.
Mr. Chair, I believe Ms. Breideck wanted to make a comment.
Okay, fine.
I'm sure it'll be brief and pithy.
We have a commissioner, too, from the
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I just wanted to clarify that this legislation would not gut the best value approach, and that is not our intent, and we think that it is a valuable option to have. There would still be the opportunity to include these other aspects, safety, key personnel, small business inclusion. For example, you could provide your safety record. You could list who your key personnel are and how much experience they have, and you could list the small contractors that you intend to use. Whether or not you can be scored more points or just the amount of points available, that's something that we would need to work out internally. There's also an opportunity to ask for a waiver from the Federal Highway Administration to sort of test new strategies to see if you can get more small business participation. So we think that this change that's just objective and measurable will not gut this, and that there still are many opportunities to evaluate those aspects of a contractor for a particular project, and we think that's an appropriate thing to do in many cases. So I just want to be clear that this would not get rid of best value, and that's not our intent.
Thank you for clarifying. Before I bring up Mr. Werke, I believe we have somebody from the Department of Administration here. Is that correct? Please come forward.
Good morning.
Thank you. If you could identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Alice Roberts Davis. I'm the Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Administration responsible for property and procurement. The Department of Administration, as you know, is the lead agency for procurement, and we have to echo our concerns this morning of our colleagues at MnDOT that we do believe that this language as proposed is actually contrary to the best value principles. From a procurement policy standpoint, the language deconstructs the idea of best value because it requires a measurable and objective set of criteria on things that are inherently subjective. And so as we talk about things such as key personnel and qualifications, it requires you to put some sort of measurement or value judgment on those different criteria. And so we don't believe that the language as drafted is helpful, and it does not actually further the best value principles.
Thank you for your testimony. I don't see any questions. Mr. Werke, you gonna wrap this up for us?
Mr. Chairman, again, Tim Werke from the Associated General Contractors. Just two quick points with respect to Mr. Raven's discussion about CMGC and best value. And I point out that when those large contracts are let's say, in excess of $200 million, you have to be a very, very sophisticated contractor in order to even propose. You have to be able to be bonded in order to be able to even put in a proposal to be considered for that. So when you get to differentiating the distinction between whose proposal is best around nebulous or ill-defined criterion, it becomes a very, very refined and less distinct determination. Because each of those contractors that are shortlisted, remember, they have to be shortlisted. If there's six contractors that propose, the department's going to shortlist to three. And by the time you get to that point, you have the best of the best. And now when you're determining based on subjectivity of criterion, it becomes, and we're talking millions of dollars, it becomes a very tenuous situation. Lastly, I would point out, on the other side of the coin, with less sophisticated public owners, the best value law is open-ended. It does not define what criterion determined value. Each of your own communities, each of your own counties and cities can put in different criterion depending upon what they feel is valuable. Contractors have to respond to that, and those differences are disruptive depending upon who you're bidding, how you're bidding, what you're bidding. So I would simply state in response that the law is undefined. It provides an open end for subjective determination between who can win and who will not win. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Rourke. Any final comments from Representative Nash?
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for hearing this. We appreciate your time.
Thank you. Members, I'm going to rewind. I apologize for this, but I missed a testifier on the previous topic, so I'm going to call forward the St. Paul Regional Chamber of Commerce. Oh, I'm sorry. I may have this wrong.
It's this Minneapolis chamber, sir, not that there is any
Thank you.
Between us.
Thank you. Please identify yourself for the record. And now we're back to the topic of bus rapid transit.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. Thank you very much. I am Sean Broom. I am the Director of Public Policy with the Minneapolis Regional Chamber of Commerce. The Minneapolis Regional Chamber is a membership-based organization representing more than 1,500 businesses in the Twin Cities. Additionally, I'm also testifying on behalf of the St. Paul Area Chamber of Commerce, their 1,200 members, and East Metro Strong, a public-private partnership that advocates for transit investment in Dakota, Ramsey, and Washington counties. We believe that arterial bus rapid transit, or ABRT, is one of the most sensible transit investments that we can make as a region. ABRT buses get people to their destinations faster by making fewer stops and by using advanced design features to save time. Custom stations with shelters, enhanced lighting, real-time schedule information, and push-button heating make ABRT a more comfortable ride for users as well. Our region's proposed ABRT network will improve some of the area's highest ridership bus lines. The first leg of our region's ABRT network, the A line, experienced a 35% increase in ridership in its very first year of operation. C line ABRT is under construction now and will connect some of the most transit-dependent riders in the state to downtown Minneapolis and all of the opportunities there. The bonding proposal for $50 million would help fund the construction of the D-Line ABRT route, the next step in our network. The D-Line will enhance one of our strongest transit corridors, connecting more than 200,000 people to 500,000 jobs. These ABRT lines benefit hundreds of thousands of people in our region and the businesses that have thousands of jobs to fill. In addition, ABRT buses are built by New Flyer, a company with over 1,000 employees in Crookston and St. Cloud. As a result, investing in ABRT has an additional positive impact across our state. The $50 million bonding proposal for ABRT delivers better, cost-effective access to jobs in the metro and supports jobs around the state. It is a win-win for everyone. We ask that you support this proposal for arterial bus rapid transit funding, and thank you very much for your consideration. I'm happy to sit for any questions.
Thank you for coming forward, and I apologize for not bringing you up in a more timely fashion. Representative Kosnick has a question.
Maybe more of a small, short statement, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the testimony. And as was mentioned, I think there is support for arterial bus lines, and unfortunately the Met Council's left since we went out of order. But I guess I only have small concern, or I think the question needs to be addressed, is how, when they're already operating with a deficient balance, not the rider per ride subsidy that I think I got confused earlier, but by adding all these lines, how are they going to pay for the ongoing subsidies of these? It's just something that I think maybe we need to explore a little bit more, but I certainly welcome the conversation of having newer, faster transit options that are a little bit more mobile and flexible. But that just is a concern that I think I needed to be, put on the record.
Thank you, Representative Kosnick. I don't believe there was a question in there, but if you'd care to comment, you certainly are welcome to.
I do not. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Kosnick. I do not think I could do the Metropolitan or Metro Transit justice in their operating budget and their plans for that specifically, but that is a very thoughtful concern,
thank
sir.
You. Well, thank you for coming forward. Thank you for your
thank
testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members, we are meeting again tomorrow morning. I believe we're back in this room again at 8:15. We'll be hearing the constitutional amendment bill. Have we got amendments to that?
Yeah, they're due at 3 o'clock.
Amendments to that are due at 3 o'clock this afternoon. We hope to get through all the testifiers tomorrow morning, but if we can't, we will have to come back tomorrow night to finish up. So any questions about what's happening? If not, we will see you all bright and early tomorrow morning here in Room 5. This meeting is adjourned.